10. After 4 years in Geneva, Sabina settled in Paris, but she could not escape her melancholy. If someone had asked her what had come over her, she would have been hard-pressed to find words for it. When we want to give expression to a dramatic situation in our lives, we tend to use metaphors of heaviness. We say that something has become a great burden to us. We either bear the burden or fail and go down with it. We struggle with it, win or lose. And Sabina, what had come over her? Nothing. She had left a man because she felt like leaving him. Had he persecuted her? Had he tried to take revenge on her? No. Her drama was a drama not of heaviness, but of lightness. What fell to her lot was not the burden, but the unbearable lightness of being. Until that time, her betrayals had filled her with excitement and joy because they opened up new paths to new adventures of betrayal. But what if the paths came to an end? One could betray one's parents, husband, country, love. But when parents, husband, country, and love were gone, what was left to betray? Sabina felt emptiness all around her. What if that emptiness was the goal of all her betrayals? Naturally, she had not realized it until now. How could she have? The goals we pursue are always veiled. A girl who longs for marriage longs for something she knows nothing about. A boy who hankers after fame has no idea what fame is. The thing that gives our every move its meaning is always totally unknown to us. Sabina was unaware of the goal that lay behind her longing to betray. The unbearable lightness of being, was that the goal? Her departure from Geneva brought her considerably closer to it. 3 years after moving to Paris, she received a letter from Prague. It was from Tomas's son. Somehow or other, he had found out about her and got hold of her address. And now he was writing to her as his father's closest friend. He informed her of the deaths of Tomas and Teresa. For the past few years, they had been living in a village where Tomas was employed as a driver at a collective farm. From time to time, they would drive over to the next town and spend the night in a cheap hotel. The road there wound through some hills, and their pickup had crashed and hurtled down a steep incline. Their bodies had been crushed to a pulp. The police determined later that the brakes were in disastrous condition. She could not get over the news. The last link to her past had been broken. According to her old habit, she decided to calm herself by taking a walk in a cemetery. The Montparnasse cemetery was the closest. It was all tiny houses, miniature chapels over each grave. Sabina could not understand why the dead would want to have imitation palaces built over them. The cemetery was vanity transmogrified into stone. Instead of growing more sensible in death, the inhabitants of the cemetery were sillier than they had been in life. Their monuments were meant to display how important they were. There were no fathers, brothers, sons, or grandmothers buried there. Only public figures, the bearers of titles, degrees, and honors. Even the postal clerk celebrated his chosen profession, his social significance, his dignity. Walking along a row of graves, she noticed people gathering for a burial. The funeral director had an armful of flowers and was giving one to each mourner. He handed one to Sabina as well. She joined the group. They made a detour past many monuments before they came to the grave, free for the moment of its heavy gravestone. She leaned over the hole. It was extremely deep. She dropped in the flower. It sailed down to the coffin in graceful somersaults. In Bohemia, the graves were not so deep. In Paris, the graves were deeper, just as the buildings were taller. Her eye fell on the stone which lay next to the grave. It chilled her, and she hurried home. She thought about that stone all day. Why had it horrified her so? She answered herself. When graves are covered with stones, the dead can no longer get out. But the dead can't get out anyway. What difference does it make whether they're covered with soil or stones? The difference is that if a grave is covered with a stone, it means we don't want the deceased to come back. The heavy stone tells the deceased, stay where you are. That made Sabina think about her father's grave. There was soil above his grave with flowers growing out of it, and a maple tree reaching down to it, and the roots and flowers offered his corpse a path out of the grave. If her father had been covered with a stone, she would never have been able to communicate with him after he died, and hear his voice in the trees, pardoning her. What was it like in the cemetery where Teresa and Tomas were buried? Once more she started thinking about them. From time to time, they would drive over to the next town and spend the night in a cheap hotel. That passage in the letter had caught her eye. It meant they were happy. And again she pictured Tomas as if he were one of her paintings. Don Juan in the foreground, a specious stage set by a naive painter, and through a crack in the set, Tristan. He died as Tristan, not as Don Juan. Sabina's parents had died in the same week, Tomas and Teresa in the same second. Suddenly she missed Franz terribly. When she told him about her cemetery walks, he gave a shiver of disgust and called cemeteries bone and stone dumps. A gulf of misunderstanding had immediately opened between them. Not until that day at the Montparnasse Cemetery did she see what he meant. She was sorry to have been so impatient with him. Perhaps if they had stayed together longer, Sabina and Franz would have begun to understand the words they used. Gradually, timorously, their vocabularies would have come together, like bashful lovers, and the music of one would have begun to intersect with the music of the other. But it was too late now. Yes, it was too late, and Sabina knew she would leave Paris and move on, and on again, because were she to die here, they would cover her up with a stone. And in the mind of a woman for whom no place is home, the thought of an end to all flight is unbearable. 11. All France's friends knew about Marie-Claude. They all knew about the girl with the oversized glasses, but no one knew about Sabina. Franz was wrong when he thought his wife had told her friends about her. Sabina was a beautiful woman, and Marie-Claude did not want people going about comparing their faces. Because Franz was so afraid of being found out, he had never asked for any of Sabina's paintings or drawings or even a snapshot of her. As a result, she disappeared from his life without a trace. There was not a scrap of tangible evidence to show that he had spent the most wonderful year of his life with her, which only increased his desire to remain faithful to her. Sometimes, when they were alone in his flat together, the girl would lift her eyes from a book, throw him an inquiring glance, and say, "What are you thinking about?" Sitting in his armchair, staring up at the ceiling, Franz always found some plausible response. But in fact he was thinking of Sabina. Whenever he published an article in a scholarly journal, the girl was the first to read it and discuss it with him, but all he could think of was what Sabina would have said about it. Everything he did for Sabina, the way Sabina would have liked to see it done. It was a perfectly innocent form of infidelity, and one eminently suited to Franz, who would never have done his bespectacled student mistress any harm. He nourished the cult of Sabina more as religion than as love. Indeed, according to the theology of that religion, it was Sabina who had sent him the girl. Between his earthly love and his unearthly love, therefore, there was perfect peace. And if unearthly love must, for theological reasons, contain a strong dose of the inexplicable and incomprehensible, we have only to recall the Dictionary of Misunderstood Words and the long lexicon of misunderstandings, his earthly love rested on true understanding. The student mistress was much younger than Sabina, and the musical composition of her life had scarcely been outlined. She was grateful to Franz for the motifs he gave her to insert. Franz's Grand March was now her creed as well. Music was now her Dionysian intoxication. They often went dancing together. They lived in truth, and nothing they did was secret. They sought out the company of friends, colleagues, students, and strangers, and enjoyed sitting, drinking, and chatting with them. They took frequent excursions to the Alps. Franz would bend over, the girl hopped onto his back, and off he ran through the meadows, declaiming at the top of his voice a long German poem his mother had taught him as a child. The girl laughed with glee, admiring his legs, shoulders, and lungs as she clasped his neck. The only thing she could not quite fathom was the curious sympathy he had for the countries occupied by the Russian Empire. On the anniversary of the invasion, they attended a memorial meeting organized by a Czech group in Geneva. The room was nearly empty. The speaker had artificially waved gray hair. He read out a long speech that bored even the few enthusiasts who had come to hear it. His French was grammatically correct, but heavily accented. From time to time, to stress a point, he would raise his index finger as if threatening the audience. The girl with the glasses could barely suppress her yawns, while Franz smiled blissfully at her side. The longer he looked at the pleasing gray-haired man with the admirable index finger, the more he saw him as a secret messenger, an angelic intermediary between him and his goddess. He closed his eyes and dreamed. He closed his eyes as he had closed them on Sabina's body, in 15 European hotels, and one in America. Part 4. Soul and Body. 1. When Teresa came home, it was almost 1:30 in the morning. She went into the bathroom, put on her pajamas, and lay down next to Tomas. He was asleep. She leaned over his face and, kissing it, detected a curious aroma coming from his hair. She took another whiff, and yet another. She sniffed him up and down like a dog, before realizing what it was. The aroma of a woman's sex organs. At 6 the alarm went off. Karenin's great moment had arrived. He always woke up much earlier than they did, but did not dare to disturb them. He would wait impatiently for the alarm, because it gave him the right to jump up on their bed, trample their bodies, and butt them with his muzzle. For a time they had tried to curb him and pushed him off the bed, but he was more headstrong than they were and ended by defending his rights. Lately, Teresa realized, she positively enjoyed being welcomed into the day by Karenin. Waking up was sheer delight for him. He always showed a naive and simple amazement at the discovery that he was back on Earth. He was sincerely pleased. She, on the other hand, awoke with great reluctance, with a desire to stave off the day by keeping her eyes closed. Now he was standing in the entrance hall, gazing up at the hat stand where his leash and collar hung ready. She slipped his head through the collar, and off they went together to do the shopping. She needed to pick up some milk, butter, and bread, and, as usual, his morning roll. Later he trotted back alongside her, roll in mouth, looking proudly from side to side, gratified by the attention he attracted from the passers-by. Once home, he would stretch out with his roll on the threshold of the bedroom and wait for Tomas to take notice of him, creep up to him, snarl at him, and make believe he was trying to snatch his roll away from him. That was how it went every day. Not until they had chased each other through the flat for at least 5 minutes would Karenin scramble under a table and gobble up the roll. This time, however, he waited in vain for his morning ritual. Tomas had a small transistor radio on the table in front of him and was listening to it intently. 2. It was a program about the Czech emigration, a montage of private conversations recorded with the latest bugging devices by a Czech spy who had infiltrated the emigre community and then returned in great glory to Prague. It was insignificant prattle, dotted with some harsh words about the occupation regime, but here and there one emigre would call another an imbecile or a fraud. These trivial remarks were the point of the broadcast. They were meant to prove not merely that émigrés had bad things to say about the Soviet Union, which neither surprised nor upset anyone in the country, but that they call one another names and make free use of dirty words. People use filthy language all day long, but when they turn on the radio and hear a well-known personality, someone they respect, saying fuck in every sentence, they feel somehow let down. It all started with Prohaska, said Tomas. Jan Prohaska, a 40-year-old Czech novelist with the strength and vitality of an ox, began criticizing public affairs vociferously even before 1968. He then became one of the best-loved figures of the Prague Spring, that dizzying liberalization of communism which ended with the Russian invasion. Shortly after the invasion, the press initiated a smear campaign against him. But the more they smeared, the more people liked him. Then, in 1970 to be exact, the Czech radio broadcast a series of private talks between Prohaska and a professor friend of his, which had taken place 2 years before, that is, in the spring of 1968. For a long time, neither of them had any idea that the professor's flat was bugged and their every step dogged. Prohaska loved to regale his friends with hyperbole and excess. Now his excesses had become weekly radio series. The secret police, who produced and directed the show, took pains to emphasize the sequences in which Prohaska made fun of his friends. Dubček, for instance. People slander their friends at the drop of a hat, but they were more shocked by the much-loved Prohaska than by the much-hated secret police. Tomas turned off the radio and said, "Every country has its secret police, but a secret police that broadcasts its tapes over the radio, there's something that could happen only in Prague, something absolutely without precedent."
"I know a precedent," said Teresa. "When I was 14, I kept a secret diary. I was terrified that someone might read it, so I kept it hidden in the attic. Mother sniffed it out. One day at dinner, while we were all hunched over our soup, she took it out of her pocket and said, 'Listen carefully now, everybody.' And after every sentence, she burst out laughing. They all laughed so hard they couldn't eat." 3. He always tried to get her to stay in bed and let him have breakfast alone. She never gave in. Tomas was at work from 7 to 4, Teresa from 4 to midnight. If she were to miss breakfast with him, the only time they could actually talk together was on Sundays. That was why she got up when he did and then went back to bed. This morning, however, she was afraid of going back to sleep, because at 10 she was due at the sauna on Zofine Island. The sauna, though coveted by the many, could accommodate only the few, and the only way to get in was by pull. Luckily, the cashier was the wife of a professor removed from the university after 1968, and the professor a friend of a former patient of Tomas's. Tomas told the patient told the professor told his wife, and Teresa had a ticket waiting for her once a week. She walked there. She detested the trams constantly packed with people, pushing into one another's hate-filled embraces, stepping on one another's feet, tearing off one another's coat buttons and shouting insults. It was drizzling. As people rushed along, they began opening umbrellas over their heads, and all at once the streets were crowded too. Arched umbrella roofs collided with one another. The men were courteous, and when passing Teresa, they held their umbrellas high over their heads and gave her room to go by. But the women would not yield. Each looked straight ahead, waiting for the other woman to acknowledge her inferiority and step aside. The meeting of the umbrellas was a test of strength. At first, Teresa gave way, but when she realized her courtesy was not being reciprocated, she started clutching her umbrella like the other women and ramming it forcefully against the oncoming umbrellas. No one ever said sorry. For the most part, no one said anything. Though, once or twice she did hear a fat cow or a fuck you. The women thus armed with umbrellas were both young and old, but the younger among them proved the more steeled warriors. Teresa recalled the days of the invasion and the girls in miniskirts carrying flags on long staffs. Theirs was a sexual vengeance. the Russian soldiers had been kept in enforced celibacy for several long years, and must have felt they had landed on a planet invented by a science fiction writer, a planet of stunning women who paraded their scorn on beautiful long legs, the likes of which had not been seen in Russia for the past 5 or 6 centuries. She had taken many pictures of those young women against a backdrop of tanks. How she had admired them. And now these same women were bumping into her, meanly and spitefully. Instead of flags, they held umbrellas, but they held them with the same pride. They were ready to fight as obstinately against a foreign army as against an umbrella that refused to move out of their way. 4. She came out into Old Town Square, the stern spires of Tin Church, the irregular rectangle of Gothic and Baroque houses. Old Town Hall, which dated from the 14th century and had once stretched over a whole side of the square, was in ruins, and had been so for 27 years. Warsaw, Dresden, Berlin, Cologne, Budapest, all were horribly scarred in the last war, but their inhabitants had built them up again and painstakingly restored the old historical sections. The people of Prague had an inferiority complex with respect to these other cities. Old Town Hall was the only monument of note destroyed in the war, and they decided to leave it in ruins so that no Pole or German could accuse them of having suffered less than their share. In front of the glorious ruins, a reminder of now and eternity, of the evils perpetrated by war, stood a steel bar reviewing stand for some demonstration or other that the Communist Party had herded the people of Prague to the day before, or would be herding them to the day after. Gazing at the remains of Old Town Hall, Teresa was suddenly reminded of her mother. That perverse need one has to expose one's ruins, one's ugliness, to parade one's misery, to uncover the stump of one's amputated arm and force the whole world to look at it. Everything had begun reminding her of her mother lately. Her mother's world, which she had fled 10 years before, seemed to be coming back to her, surrounding her on all sides. That was why she told Tomas that morning about how her mother had read her secret diary at the dinner table to the accompaniment of guffaws. When a private talk over a bottle of wine is broadcast on the radio, what can it mean but that the world is turning into a concentration camp? Almost from childhood, Teresa had used the term to express how she felt about life with her family. A concentration camp is a world in which people live crammed together constantly, night and day. Brutality and violence are merely secondary, and not in the least indispensable, characteristics. A concentration camp is the complete obliteration of privacy. Prohaska, who was not allowed to chat with a friend over a bottle of wine in the shelter of privacy, lived, unknown to him, a fatal error on his part, in a concentration camp. Teresa lived in a concentration camp when she lived with her mother. Almost from childhood, she knew that a concentration camp was nothing exceptional or startling, but something very basic, a given, into which we are born and from which we can escape only with the greatest of efforts. 5. The women sitting on the 3 terraced benches were packed in so tightly that they could not help touching. Sweating away next to Teresa was a woman of about 30 with a very pretty face. She had 2 unbelievably large pendulous breasts hanging from her shoulders, bouncing at the slightest movement. When the woman got up, Teresa saw that her behind was also like 2 enormous sacks, and that it had nothing in common with her fine face. Perhaps the woman stood frequently in front of the mirror, observing her body, trying to peer through it into her soul, as Teresa had done since childhood. Surely she, too, had harbored the blissful hope of using her body as a poster for her soul. But what a monstrous soul it would have to be if it reflected that body, that rack for 4 pouches. Teresa got up and rinsed herself off under the shower. Then she went out into the open. It was still drizzling. standing just above the Volturva on a slatted deck, and sheltered from the eyes of the city by a few square feet of tall wooden panel, she looked down to see the head of the woman she had just been thinking about. It was bobbing on the surface of the rushing river. The woman smiled up at her. She had a delicate nose, large brown eyes, and a childish glance. As she climbed the ladder, her tender features gave way to two sets of quivering pouches, spraying tiny drops of cold water right and left. 6. Teresa went in to get dressed and stood in front of the large mirror. No, there was nothing monstrous about her body. She had no pouches hanging from her shoulders. In fact, her breasts were quite small. Her mother used to ridicule her for having such small breasts, and she had had a complex about them until Tomas came along. But reconciled to their size as she was still mortified by the very large, very dark circles around her nipples. Had she been able to design her own body, she would have chosen inconspicuous nipples, the kind that scarcely protrude from the arch of the breast and all but blend in color with the rest of the skin. She thought of her aureoli as big crimson targets painted by a primitivist of pornography for the poor. Looking at herself, she wondered what she would be like if her nose grew a millimeter a day. How long would it take before her face began to look like someone else's? And if various parts of her body began to grow and shrink, and Teresa no longer looked like herself, would she still be herself? Would she still be Teresa? Of course. Even if Teresa were completely unlike Teresa, her soul inside her would be the same, and look on in amazement at what was happening to her body. Then what was the relationship between Teresa and her body? Had her body the right to call itself Teresa? And if not, then what did the name refer to? Merely something incorporeal, intangible? These are questions that have been going through Teresa's head since she was a child. Indeed, the only truly serious questions are ones that even a child can formulate. Only the most naive of questions are truly serious. They are the questions with no answers. A question with no answer is a barrier that cannot be breached. In other words, it is questions with no answers that set the limits of human possibilities, describe the boundaries of human existence. Teresa stood bewitched before the mirror, staring at her body as if it were alien to her, alien and yet assigned to her and no one else. She felt disgusted by it. It lacked the power to become the only body in Tomas's life. It had disappointed and deceived her. All that night she had to inhale the aroma of another woman's groin from his hair. Suddenly she longed to dismiss her body as one dismisses a servant, to stay on with Tomas only as a soul, and send her body into the world to behave as other female bodies behave with male bodies. If her body had failed to become the only body for Tomas, and thereby lost her the biggest battle of her life, it could just as well go off on its own. 7. She went home and forced herself to eat a stand-up lunch in the kitchen. At 3:30, she put Karenin on his leash and walking again, to the outskirts of the town where her hotel was. When they fired Teresa from her job at the magazine, she found work behind the bar of a hotel. It happened several months after she came back from Zurich. They could not forgive her in the end for the week she spent photographing Russian tanks. She got the job through friends, other people who had taken refuge there when thrown out of work by the Russians, a former professor of theology in the accounting office, an ambassador who had protested against the invasion on foreign television at the reception desk. She was worried about her legs again. While working as a waitress in a small-town restaurant, she had been horrified at the sight of the older waitress's varicose veins, a professional hazard that came of a life of walking, running, and standing with heavy loads. But the new job was less demanding. Although she began each shift by dragging out heavy cases of beer and mineral water, All she had to do then was stand behind the bar, serve the customers their drinks, and wash out the glasses in the small sink on her side of the bar. And through it all she had Karenin, lying docilely at her feet. It was long past midnight before she had finished her accounts and delivered the cash receipts to the hotel director. She then went to say goodbye to the ambassador, who had night duty. The door behind the reception desk led to a tiny room with a narrow cot where he could take a nap. The wall above the cot was covered with framed photographs of himself and various people smiling at the camera, or shaking his hand, or sitting next to him at a table and signing something or other. Some of them were autographed. In the place of honor hung a picture showing, side by side with his own face, the smiling face of John F. Kennedy. When Teresa entered the room that night, she found him talking not to Kennedy, but to a man of about 60 whom she had never seen before and who fell silent as soon as he saw her. "It's all right," said the ambassador. "She's a friend. You can speak freely in front of her." Then he turned to Teresa. "His son got 5 years today." During the first days of the invasion, she learned, the man's son and some friends had stood watch over the entrance to a building housing the Russian Army special staff. Since any Czechs they saw coming or going were clearly agents in the service of the Russians, he and his friends trailed them, traced the number plates of their cars, and passed on the information to the pro-Dubček clandestine radio and television broadcasters, who then warned the public. In the process, the boy and his friends had given one of the traitors a thorough going over. The boy's father said, "This photograph was the only corpus delicti. He denied it all until they showed it to him." He took a clipping out of his wallet. "It came out in the Times in the autumn of 1968. It was a picture of a young man grabbing another man by the throat and a crowd looking on in the background. "Collaborator punished," read the caption. Teresa let out her breath. No, it wasn't one of hers. Walking home with Karenin through nocturnal Prague, she thought of the day she had spent photographing tanks. How naive they had been, thinking they were risking their lives for their country, when in fact they were helping the Russian police. She got home at 1:30. Tomas was asleep. His hair gave off the aroma of a woman's groin. 8. What is flirtation? One might say that it is behavior leading another to believe that sexual intimacy is possible, while preventing that possibility from becoming a certainty. In other words, flirting is a promise of sexual intercourse without a guarantee. When Teresa stood behind the bar, the men whose drinks she poured flirted with her. Was she annoyed by the unending ebb and flow of flattery, double entendres, off-color stories, propositions, smiles, and glances? Not in the least. She had an irresistible desire to expose her body, that alien body she wanted to expel into the big wide world, to the undertow. Tomas kept trying to convince her that love and lovemaking were two different things. She refused to understand. Now she was surrounded by men she did not care for in the slightest. What would making love with them be like? She yearned to try it, if only in the form of that no-guarantee promise called flirting. Let there be no mistake. Teresa did not wish to take revenge on Tomas. She merely wished to find a way out of the maze. She knew that she had become a burden to him. She took things too seriously, turned everything into a tragedy, and failed to grasp the lightness and amusing insignificance of physical love. How she wished she could learn lightness. She yearned for someone to help her out of her anachronistic shell. If for some women flirting is second nature, insignificant, routine, for Teresa it had developed into an important field of research, with the goal of teaching her who she was and what she was capable of. But by making it important and serious, she deprived it of its lightness, and it became forced, labored, overdone. She disturbed the balance between promise and lack of guarantee, which, when maintained, is a sign of flirtistic virtuosity. She promised too ardently, and without making it clear that the promise involved no guarantee on her part. Which is another way of saying that she gave everyone the impression of being there for the taking. But when men responded by asking for what they felt they had been promised, they met with strong resistance, and their only explanation for it was that she was deceitful and malicious. 9. One day, a boy of about 16 perched himself on a bar stool and dropped a few provocative phrases that stood out in the general conversation like a false line in a drawing, a line that can be neither continued nor erased. "That's some pair of legs you've got there." "So you can see through wood?" she fired back. "I've watched you in the street," he responded. But by then she had turned away and was serving another customer. When she finished, he ordered a cognac. She shook her head. "But I'm 18," he objected. "May I see your identification card?" Teresa said. "You may not," the boy answered. "Then how about a soft drink?" said Teresa. Without a word, the boy stood up from the bar stool and left. He was back about a half hour later. With exaggerated gestures, he took a seat at the bar. There was enough alcohol on his breath to cover a 10-foot radius. "Give me that soft drink," he commanded. "Why, you're drunk," said Teresa. The boy pointed to a sign hanging on the wall behind Teresa's back. "Sale of alcoholic beverages to minors is strictly prohibited." "You are prohibited from serving me alcohol," he said, sweeping his arm from the sign to Teresa. "But I am not prohibited from being drunk." "Where did you get so drunk?" Teresa asked. "In the bar, across the street," he said, laughing, and asked again for a soft drink. "Well, why didn't you stay there?" "Because I wanted to look at you," he said. "I love you." His face oddly contorted as he said it, and Teresa had trouble deciding whether he was sneering, making advances, or joking. Or was he simply so drunk that he had no idea what he was saying? She put the soft drink down in front of him and went back to her other customers. The "I love you" seemed to have exhausted the boy's resources. He emptied his glass in silence, left money on the counter, and slipped out before Teresa had time to look up again. A moment after he left, a short, bald-headed man, who was on his third vodka, said, "You ought to know that serving young people alcohol is against the law." "I didn't serve him alcohol. That was a soft drink."
"I saw what you slipped into it."
"What are you talking about?"
"Give me another vodka," said the bald man, and added, "I've had my eye on you for some time now." "Then why not be grateful for the view of a beautiful woman and keep your mouth shut?" interjected a tall man who had stepped up to the bar in time to observe the entire scene. "You stay out of this," shouted the bald man. "What business is it of yours?"
"And what business is it of yours, if I may ask?" the tall man retorted. Teresa served the bald man his vodka. He downed it at one gulp, paid, and departed. "Thank you," said Teresa to the tall man.
"Don't mention it," said the tall man, and went his way too.
10. A few days later, he turned up at the bar again. When she saw him, she smiled at him like a friend. "Thanks again. That bald fellow comes in all the time. He's terribly unpleasant."
"Forget him."
"What makes him want to hurt me?"
"He's a petty little drunk. Forget him."
"If you say so." The tall man looked in her eyes.
"Promise?"
"I promise."
"I like hearing you make promises," he said, still looking in her eyes.
The flirtation was on. The behavior leading another to believe that sexual intimacy is possible, even though the possibility itself remains in the realm of theory, in suspense.
"What's a beautiful girl like you doing in the ugliest part of Prague?"
"And you," she countered, "what are you doing in the ugliest part of Prague?" He told her he lived nearby. He was an engineer and had stopped off on his way home from work the other day by sheer chance. 11. When Teresa looked at Tomas, her eyes went not to his eyes, but to a point 3 or 4 inches higher, to his hair, which gave off the aroma of other women's groins. I can't take it any more, Tomas. I know I shouldn't complain. Ever since you came back to Prague for me, I've forbidden myself to be jealous. I don't want to be jealous. I suppose I'm just not strong enough to stand up to it. Help me, please. He put his arm in hers and took her to the park, where years before they had gone on frequent walks. The park had red, blue, and yellow benches. They sat down. I understand you. I know what you want, said Tomas. I've taken care of everything. All you have to do is climb Petrine Hill. Petrine Hill? She felt a surge of anxiety. Why Petrine Hill? You'll see when you get up there. She was terribly upset about the idea of going. Her body was so weak that she could scarcely lift it off the bench. But she was constitutionally unable to disobey Tomas. She forced herself to stand. She looked back. He was still sitting on the bench, smiling at her, almost cheerfully. With a wave of the hand, he signaled her to move on. 12. Coming out at the foot of Petrine Hill, that great green mound rising up in the middle of Prague, she was surprised to find it devoid of people. This was strange, because at other times half of Prague seemed to be milling about. It made her anxious. But the hill was so quiet, and the quiet so comforting, that she yielded fully to its embrace. On her way up, she paused several times to look back. Below her, she saw the towers and bridges. The saints were shaking their fists and lifting their stone eyes to the clouds. It was the most beautiful city in the world. At last she reached the top, beyond the ice cream and souvenir stands, none of which happened to be open, stretched a broad lawn spotted here and there with trees. She noticed several men on the lawn. The closer she came to them, the slower she walked. There were 6 in all. They were standing or strolling along at a leisurely pace, like golfers looking over the course and weighing various clubs in their hands, trying to get into the proper frame of mind for a match. She finally came near them. Of the 6 men, 3 were there to play the same role as she. They were unsettled. They seemed eager to ask all sorts of questions, but feared making nuisances of themselves and so held their tongues and merely looked about inquisitively. The other 3 radiated condescending benevolence. One of them had a rifle in his hand. Spotting Teresa, he waved at her and said with a smile, "Yes, this is the place." She gave a nod in reply, but still felt extremely anxious. The man added, "To avoid an error, this was your choice, wasn't it?" It would have been easy to say, "No, no, it wasn't my choice at all." But she could not imagine disappointing Tomas. What excuse, what apology could she find for going back home? And so she said, "Yes, of course, it was my choice." The man with the rifle continued, "Let me explain why I wish to know. The only time we do this is when we are certain that the people who come to us have chosen to die of their own accord. We consider it a service." He gave her so quizzical a glance that she had to assure him once more. "No, no, don't worry. It was my choice." "Would you like to go first?" he asked. Because she wanted to put off the execution as long as she could, she said, "No, please no. If it's at all possible, I'd like to be last." "As you please," he said, and went off to the others. Neither of his assistants was armed. Their sole function was to attend to the people who were to die. They took them by the arms and walked them across the lawn. The grassy surface proved quite an expanse. It ran as far as the eye could see. The people to be executed were allowed to choose their own trees. They paused at each one and looked it over carefully, unable to make up their minds. Two of them eventually chose plane trees, but the third wandered on and on, no tree apparently striking him worthy of his death. The assistant who held him by the arm guided him along gently and patiently, until at last the man lost the courage to go on and stopped at a luxuriant maple. Then the assistants blindfolded all three men. And so three men, their eyes blindfolded, their heads turned to the sky, stood with their backs against three trees on the endless lawn. The man with a rifle took aim and fired. There was nothing to be heard but the singing of birds. The rifle was equipped with a silencing device. There was nothing to be seen but the collapse of the man who had been leaning against the maple. Without taking a step, the man with the rifle turned in a different direction, and one of the other men silently crumpled. And seconds later, again the man with the rifle merely turned in place. The third man sank to the lawn. 13. One of the assistants went up to Teresa. He was holding a dark blue ribbon. She realized he had come to blindfold her. "No," she said, shaking her head. "I want to watch." But that was not the real reason why she refused to be blindfolded. She was not one of those heroic types who are determined to stare down the firing squad. She simply wanted to postpone death. Once her eyes were covered, she would be in death's antechamber, from which there was no return. The man did not force her. He merely took her arm. But as they walked across the open lawn, Teresa was unable to choose a tree. No one forced her to hurry, but she knew that in the end she would not escape. Seeing a flowering chestnut ahead of her, she walked up and stopped in front of it. She leaned back against its trunk and looked up. She saw the leaves resplendent in the sun. She heard the sounds of the city, faint and sweet, like thousands of distant violins. The man raised his rifle. Teresa felt her courage slipping away. Her weakness drove her to despair, but she could do nothing to counteract it. "But it wasn't my choice," she said. He immediately lowered the barrel of his rifle and said in a gentle voice, "If it wasn't your choice, we can't do it. We haven't the right." He said it kindly, as if apologizing to Teresa for not being able to shoot her, if it was not her choice. His kindness tore at her heartstrings, and she turned her face to the bark of the tree and burst into tears. 14. Her whole body racked with sobs, she embraced the tree as if it were not a tree, as if it were her long-lost father, a grandfather she had never known, a great-grandfather, a great-great-grandfather, a hoary old man, come to her from the depths of time to offer her his face in the form of rough tree bark. Then she turned her head. The three men were far off in the distance by then, wandering across the green sward like golfers. The one with the rifle even held it like a golf club. Walking down the paths of Petrine Hill, she could not wean her thoughts from the man who was supposed to shoot her but did not. Oh, how she longed for him. Someone had to help her, after all. Tomas wouldn't. Tomas was sending her to her death. Someone else would have to help her. The closer she got to the city, the more she longed for the man with the rifle, and the more she feared Tomas. He would never forgive her for failing to keep her word. He would never forgive her for her cowardice, her betrayal. She had come to the street where they lived, and knew she would see him in a minute or two. She was so afraid of seeing him that her stomach was in knots, and she thought she was going to be sick. 15. The engineer started trying to lure her up to his flat. She refused the first two invitations, but accepted the third. After her usual stand-up lunch in the kitchen, she set off. It was just before 2. As she approached his house, she could feel her legs slowing down of their own accord. But then it occurred to her that she was actually being sent to him by Tomas. Hadn't he told her time and again that love and sexuality had nothing in common? Well, she was merely testing his words, confirming them. She could almost hear him say, "I understand you. I know what you want. I've taken care of everything. You'll see when you get up there." Yes, all she was doing was following Tomas's commands. She wouldn't stay long. Long enough for a cup of coffee. Long enough to feel what it was like to reach the very border of infidelity. She would push her body up to the border, let it stand there for a moment as at the stake, and then, when the engineer tried to put his arms around her, she would say, as she said to the man with the rifle on Petrine Hill, "It wasn't my choice." Whereupon the man would lower the barrel of his rifle and say in a gentle voice, "If it wasn't your choice, I can't do it. I haven't the right." And she would turn her face to the bark of the tree and burst into tears. 16. The building had been constructed at the turn of the century in a workers' district of Prague. She entered a hall with dirty, whitewashed walls, climbed a flight of worn stone stairs with iron banisters, and turned to the left. It was the second door. No name, no bell. She knocked. He opened the door. The entire flat consisted of a single room with a curtain setting off the first 5 or 6 feet from the rest, and therefore forming a kind of makeshift anteroom. It had a table, a hot plate, and a refrigerator. Stepping beyond the curtain, she saw the oblong of a window at the end of a long, narrow space, with books along one side and a daybed and armchair against the other. "It's a very simple place I have here," said the engineer. "I hope you don't find it depressing." "No, not at all," said Teresa, looking at the wall covered with bookshelves. He had no desk, but hundreds of books. She liked seeing them, and the anxiety that had plagued her died down somewhat. From childhood, she had regarded books as emblems of a secret brotherhood. A man with this sort of library couldn't possibly hurt her. He asked her what she'd like to drink. Wine? No wine. Coffee, if anything. He disappeared behind the curtain, and she went over to the bookshelves. One of the books caught her eye at once. It was a translation of Sophocles' Oedipus. How odd to find it here. Years ago, Tomas had given it to her, and after she had read it, he went on and on about it. Then he sent his reflections to a newspaper, and the article turned their life upside down. But now, just looking at the spine of the book seemed to calm her. It made her feel as though Tomas had purposefully left a trace, a message that her presence here was his doing. She took the book off the shelf and opened it. When the tall engineer came back into the room, she would ask him why he had it, whether he had read it, and what he thought of it. That would be her ruse to turn the conversation away from the hazardous terrain of a stranger's flat to the intimate world of Tomas's thoughts. Then she felt his hand on her shoulder. The man took the book out of her hand, put it back on the shelf without a word, and led her over to the daybed. Again she recalled the words she had used with the Petrine executioner, and said them aloud. "But it wasn't my choice." She believed them to be a miraculous formula that would instantly change the situation. But in that room, the words lost their magic power. I have a feeling they even strengthened the man in his resolve. He pressed her to himself and put his hand on her breast. Oddly enough, the touch of his hand immediately erased what remained of her anxiety, for the engineer's hand referred to her body, and she realized that she, her soul, was not at all involved, only her body alone, the body that had betrayed her and that she had sent out into the world among other bodies. 17. He undid the first button on her blouse and indicated she was to continue. She did not comply. She had sent her body out into the world and refused to take any responsibility for it. She neither resisted nor assisted him. her soul thereby announcing that it did not condone what was happening, but had decided to remain neutral. She was nearly immobile while he undressed her. When he kissed her, her lips failed to react. But suddenly she felt her groin becoming moist, and she was afraid. The excitement she felt was all the greater because she was excited against her will. In other words, her soul did condone the proceedings, albeit covertly. But she also knew that if the feeling of excitement was to continue, her soul's approval would have to keep mute. The moment it said its yes aloud, the moment it tried to take an active part in the love scene, the excitement would subside. For what made the soul so excited was that the body was acting against its will. The body was betraying it, and the soul was looking on. Then he pulled off her panties, and she was completely naked. When her soul saw her naked body in the arms of a stranger, it was so incredulous that it might as well have been watching the planet Mars at close range. In the light of the incredible, the soul for the first time saw the body as something other than banal. For the first time, it looked on the body with fascination. All the body's matchless, inimitable, unique qualities had suddenly come to the fore. This was not the most ordinary of bodies, as the soul had regarded it until then. This was the most extraordinary body. The soul could not tear its eyes away from the body's birthmark, the round, brown blemish above its hairy triangle. It looked upon that mark as its seal, a holy seal it had imprinted on the body. And now a stranger's penis was moving blasphemously close to it. Peering into the engineer's face, she realized that she would never allow her body, on which her soul had left its mark, to take pleasure in the embrace of someone she neither knew nor wished to know. She was filled with an intoxicating hatred. She collected a gob of saliva to spit in the stranger's face. He was observing her with as much eagerness as she him, and noting her rage, he quickened the pace of his movements on her body. Teresa could feel orgasm advancing from afar, and shouted, "No, no, no," to resist it. But resisted, constrained, deprived of an outlet, the ecstasy lingered all the longer in her body, flowing through her veins like a shot of morphine. She thrashed in his arms, swung her fists in the air, and spat in his face. 18. Toilets in modern water closets rise from the floor like white water lilies. The architect does all he can to make the body forget how paltry it is, and to make man ignore what happens to his intestinal wastes after the water from the tank flushes them down the drain. Even though the sewer pipelines reach far into our houses with their tentacles, they are carefully hidden from view, and we are happily ignorant of the invisible Venice of shit underlying our bathrooms, bedrooms, dance halls, and parliaments. The bathroom in the old working-class flat on the outskirts of Prague was less hypocritical. The floor was covered with gray tile, and the toilet rising up from it was broad, squat, and pitiful. It did not look like a white water lily. It looked like what it was, the enlarged end of a sewer pipe. And since it lacked even a wooden seat, Teresa had to perch on the cold enamel rim. She was sitting there on the toilet, and her sudden desire to void her bowels was in fact a desire to go to the extreme of humiliation, to become only and utterly a body. The body, her mother used to say, was good for nothing but digesting and excreting. And as she voided her bowels, Teresa was overcome by a feeling of infinite grief and loneliness. Nothing could be more miserable than her naked body perched on the enlarged end of a sewer pipe. Her soul had lost its onlooker's curiosity, its malice and pride. It had retreated deep into the body again, to the farthest gut, waiting desperately for someone to call it out. 19. She stood up from the toilet, flushed it, and went into the anteroom. The soul trembled in her body, her naked, spurned body. She still felt on her anus the touch of the paper she had used to wipe herself. And suddenly something unforgettable occurred. Suddenly she felt a desire to go into him and hear his voice, his words. If he spoke to her in a soft, deep voice, her soul would take courage and rise to the surface of her body, and she would burst out crying. She would put her arms around him the way she had put her arms around the chestnut tree's thick trunk in her dream. Standing there in the anteroom, she tried to withstand the strong desire to burst out crying in his presence. She knew that her failure to withstand it would have ruinous consequences. She would fall in love with him. Just then, his voice called to her from the inner room. Now that she heard that voice by itself, divorced from the engineer's tall stature, it amazed her. It was high-pitched and thin. How could she have ignored it all this time? Perhaps the surprise of that unpleasant voice was what saved her from temptation. She went inside, picked up her clothes from the floor, threw them on, and left. 20. She had done her shopping and was on her way home. Karenin had the usual roll in his mouth. It was a cold morning, there was a slight frost. They were passing a housing development, where in the spaces between buildings the tenants maintained small flower and vegetable gardens, when Karenin suddenly stood stock still and riveted his eyes on something. She looked over but could see nothing out of the ordinary. Karenin gave a tug, and she followed along behind. Only then did she notice the black head and large beak of a crow lying on the cold dirt of a barren plot. The bodiless head bobbed slowly up and down, and the beak gave out an occasional hoarse and mournful croak. Karenin was so excited he dropped his roll. Teresa tied him to a tree to prevent him from hurting the crow. Then she knelt down and tried to dig up the soil that had been stamped down around the bird to bury it alive. It was not easy. She broke a nail. The blood began to flow. All at once, a rock landed nearby. She turned and caught sight of 2 9- or 10-year-old boys peeking out from behind a wall. She stood up. They saw her move, saw the dog by the tree, and ran off. Once more she knelt down and scratched away at the dirt. At last she succeeded in pulling the crow out of its grave. But the crow was lame and could neither walk nor fly. She wrapped it up in the red scarf she had been wearing around her neck and pressed it to her body with her left hand. With her right hand, she untied Karenin from the tree. It took all the strength she could muster to quiet him down and make him heal. She rang the doorbell, not having a free hand for the key. Tomas opened the door. She handed him the leash and, with the words, "Hold him," took the crow into the bathroom. She laid it on the floor under the wash basin. It flapped its wings a little, but could move no more than that. There was a thick, yellow liquid oozing from it. She made a bed of old rags to protect it from the cold tiles. From time to time, the bird would give a hopeless flap of its lame wing and raise its beak as a reproach. 21. She sat transfixed on the edge of the bath, unable to take her eyes off the dying crow. In its solitude and desolation, she saw a reflection of her own fate, and she repeated several times to herself, "I have no one left in the world but Tomas." Did her adventure with the engineer teach her that casual sex has nothing to do with love, that it is light, weightless? Was she calmer now? Not in the least. She kept picturing the following scene. She'd come out of the toilet and her body was standing in the anteroom, naked and spurned. Her soul was trembling, terrified, buried in the depths of her bowels. If, at that moment, the man in the inner room had addressed her soul, she would have burst out crying and fallen into his arms. She imagined what it would have been like if the woman standing in the anteroom had been one of Tomas's mistresses, and if the man inside had been Tomas. All he would have had to do was say one word, a single word, and the girl would have thrown her arms around him and wept. Teresa knew what happens during the moment love is born. A woman cannot resist the voice calling forth her terrified soul. The man cannot resist the woman whose soul thus responds to his voice. Tomas had no defense against the lure of love, and Teresa feared for him every minute of every hour. What weapons did she have at her disposal? None but her fidelity. And she offered him that at the very outset, the very first day, as if aware she had nothing more to give. Their love was an oddly asymmetrical construction. It was supported by the absolute certainty of her fidelity, like a gigantic edifice supported by a single column. Before long, the crow stopped flapping its wings and gave no more than the twitch of a broken, mangled leg. Teresa refused to be separated from it. She could have been keeping vigil over a dying sister. In the end, however, she did step into the kitchen for a bite to eat. When she returned, the crow was dead. 22. In the first year of her love, Teresa would cry out during intercourse. Screaming, as I have pointed out, was meant to blind and deafen the senses. With time, she screamed less, but her soul was still blinded by love and saw nothing. Making love with the engineer in the absence of love was what finally restored her soul's sight. During her next visit to the sauna, she stood before the mirror again, and looking at herself, reviewed the scene of physical love that had taken place in the engineer's flat. It was not her lover she remembered. In fact, she would have been hard put to describe him. She may not even have noticed what he looked like naked. What she did remember, and what she now observed, aroused, in the mirror, was her own body, her pubic triangle, and the circular blotch located just above it. The blotch, which until then she had regarded as the most prosaic of skin blemishes, had become an obsession. She longed to see it again and again in the implausible proximity to an alien penis. Here I must stress again. She had no desire to see another man's organs. She wished to see her own private parts in close proximity to an alien penis. She did not desire her lover's body. She desired her own body, newly discovered, intimate and alien beyond all others, incomparably exciting. Looking at her body speckled with droplets of shower water, she imagined the engineer dropping in at the bar. Oh, how she longed for him to come, longed for him to invite her back. Oh, how she yearned for it. 23. Every day she feared that the engineer would make his appearance and she would be unable to say no. But the days passed, and the fear that he would come merged gradually into the dread that he would not. A month had gone by, and still the engineer stayed away. Teresa found it inexplicable. Her frustrated desire receded and turned into a troublesome question. Why did he fail to come? Waiting on customers one day, she came upon the bald-headed man who had attacked her for serving alcohol to a minor. He was telling a dirty joke in a loud voice. It was a joke she had heard 100 times before from the drunks in the small town where she once served beer. Once more, she had the feeling that her mother's world was intruding on her. She curtly interrupted the bald man. "I don't take orders from you," the man responded in a huff. "You ought to thank your lucky stars we let you stay here in the bar." "We? Who do you mean by we?" "Us," said the man, holding up his glass for another vodka. "I won't have any more insults out of you, is that clear? Oh, and by the way," he added, pointing to Teresa's neck, which was wound round with a strand of cheap pearls. "Where did you get those from? You can't tell me your husband gave them to you. A window washer? He can't afford gifts like that. It's your customers, isn't it? I wonder what you give them in exchange." "You shut your mouth this instant," she hissed. "Just remember that prostitution is a criminal offense," he went on, trying to grab hold of the necklace. Suddenly Karenin jumped up, leaned his front paws on the bar, and began to snarl. 24. The ambassador said,
He's with the secret police.
Then why is he so open about it? What good is a secret police that can't keep its secrets?
The ambassador positioned himself on the cot by folding his legs under his body, as he had learned to do in yoga class. Kennedy, beaming down on him from the frame on the wall, gave his words a special consecration.
"The secret police have several functions, my dear," he began in an avuncular tone. "The first is the classical one. They keep an ear out for what people are saying and report it to their superiors. The second function is intimidatory. They want to make it seem as if they have us in their power. They want us to be afraid. That is what your bald-headed friend was after. The third function consists of staging situations that will compromise us. Gone are the days when they tried to accuse us of plotting the downfall of the state. That would only increase our popularity. Now they slip hashish in our pockets or claim we've raped a 12-year-old girl. They can always dig up some girl to back them."
The engineer immediately popped back into Therese's mind. Why had he never come?
"They need to trap people," the ambassador went on, "to force them to collaborate and set other traps for other people, so that gradually they can turn the whole nation into a single organization of informers."
Teresa could think of nothing but the possibility that the engineer had been sent by the police. And who was that strange boy who drank himself silly and told her he loved her? It was because of him that the bald police spy had launched into her and the engineer stood up for her. So all three had been playing parts in a prearranged scenario meant to soften her up for the seduction.
How could she have missed it? The flat was so odd, and he didn't belong there at all. Why would an elegantly dressed engineer live in a miserable place like that? Was he an engineer? And if so, how could he leave work at 2 in the afternoon? Besides, how many engineers read Sophocles? No, that was no engineer's library. The whole place had more the flavor of a flat, confiscated from a poor, imprisoned intellectual. Her father was put in prison when she was 10, and the state had confiscated their flat and all her father's books. Who knows to what use the flat had then been put? Now she saw clearly why the engineer had never returned. He had accomplished his mission. What mission? The drunken undercover agent had inadvertently given it away when he said, "Just remember that prostitution is a criminal offense." Now that self-styled engineer would testify that she had slept with him and demanded to be paid. They would threaten to blow it up into a scandal, unless she agreed to report on the people who got drunk in her bar.
"Don't worry," the ambassador comforted her. "Your story doesn't sound the least bit dangerous."
"I suppose it doesn't," she said in a tight voice, as she walked out into the Prague night with Karenin.